Vice Chancellor, friends, colleagues, students, and most welcome guests to Sussex University. In this moment, when academics are continually asked to produce two-year, five-year, short-term, long-term, medium-term research plans, I want to use this occasion to remind us that however carefully we might try to plan it, research is an adventure. Examined, that adventure can be turned into what my Sussex colleagues, Maya Unitan and Geert Deneve, call a critical journey, in the course of which we can reflect on our engagement with different kinds of fields and on the kinds of knowledge we produce from them. This lecture is itself one such journey. I hope to give you a glimpse of the passions that inspired me to travel to and immerse myself in certain research locations, which were always simultaneously real places and conceptual sites of problems and questions, and the puzzles that drove me onward to new places and new questions. If, given the trick of retrospection, this journey seems like one of organic unfolding, it is also one of contingency and serendipity. It's always difficult to know where to begin, but in an important sense, my critical journey began with my first journey to Greece. I was 21 and had enrolled in Study in Greece, a small study abroad operation that Catherine Butterworth, Irish-American but long-term Athens resident, ran out of her Athenian apartment. It was the kind of operation that, with all the demands of auditing and accreditation, probably couldn't survive today, but it was absolutely brilliant. Using her own personal networks, Catherine found us teachers who typically were not just academics, but also practitioners. I studied Greek poetry with a poet and learned to dance Greek folk and urban dances with one of Greece's most formidable field researchers, Ted Petrides. Our teachers taught us mostly in their homes, two to eight at a time, over coffee or glasses of cognac, in classes that often stretched over the whole afternoon. With the intuitions of an anthropologist, Catherine insisted that outside of our courses, we should spend a lot of time with Greeks, doing with them whatever it is that they do. This year was the start of a lifelong relationship with Greek society, a kind of addiction with its highs and lows. It has been crucial for my understandings and approach that I first entered this society at a time of great ferment, July 1975, a year after the seven-year military junta had collapsed. Greece called this period the Metapolitavsi, the moment of political change. It was a time of optimism, energy, and huge creativity in poetry, theater, and music. Political parties of the left, previously banned, were making up for lost time, organizing meetings, rallies, and especially concerts. Students never seemed to study except before exams. They spent all their time talking politics and philosophy and listening to music. I learned Greek as well as the meanings of the social notion of the parea, the company of friends, through almost daily afternoon visits to my Greek friends in stark, chilly Athenian student apartments, followed by long dinners and jugs of cheap retsina at neighborhood tavernas. Dinner never finished until well past midnight, and we often moved on to the next place to hear live music and to dance, and top the night off with coffee at sunrise. Not surprisingly, I remember Greece through a haze of bodily memories, a body vibrating from always over-amplified music, the ache of tiredness and too much retsina. What I remember in particular is the way politics were expressed and lived through music. Banned under the dictatorship, the songs of Theodorakis reverberated everywhere, not only at the frequent concerts that political parties organized in the big stadia, but from ghetto blasters at building sites, in shops, from kitchens. 1975 was also the beginning of the Rebetika revival. Rebetika were a kind of urban blues that developed out of the cosmopolitan traditions of the Aegean port cities like Smyrna, Istanbul, Salonika, Piraeus. In this music, singers explored the experience of modernity, migration, and urban life of the early 20th century Southeast Europe. Many songs articulate the loss, dislocation, and poetry resulting from the massive population exchanges between 1922 and 23, or in 1922 and 23, between Turkey and Greece, the tragic consequence of an ideology of pure nations. But they could also be grimly, defiantly cheerful, like this jaunty song to the Zabekiko dance rhythm, recorded in New York City in the mid-1940s by Amalia, whose story we will return to later. Taking on a male persona, she says in her song, "Since I was little, I've lived in foreign lands all around the world, and I've never kept a dime in my pocket. Now I've decided to calm down the madness of my youth, to forget it all. Now I've got married to a coquette. I love her, and she loves me, and we have a grand time." To give you a flavor. Like Theodorakis' songs, Rebetika's songs had been banned under the dictatorship, yet the traditional left parties had never liked them much either, disapproving of their fatalism, political lassitude, indulgence in a world of emotions, love, hashish, as well as their occasional cocky defiance. The newfound popularity of Rebetika among ordinary people, and also the popularity of the songs of the East, Anatolitika, expressed a turn toward an Eastern, Oriental element of Greek experience that both a puritanical left and a brutal U.S.-supported right had repressed. While very much a part of Greece's of a reassessment of Greece's position in relation to the West in the post-dictatorship moment, these songs of the early 20th century made the past newly present in Greek public life. For me, they were a premonition of a later project. That year, I was also drawn into dancing, something which, certainly in 1975, was a regular feature of Greek life. Western perceptions of Greek dancing are mediated by filmic images. Think of Melina Mercouri, the hooker with a heart of gold, dancing lustily on the quay with a bevy of handsome Greek sailors in Never on Sunday. And Anthony Quinn as Zorba the Greek, dancing barefoot on a Cretan beach. As I attended many different dance events, village weddings and celebrations, spontaneous dancing at cafes and restaurants, urban nightclubs, formal dances of migrants' associations in Athens, I became aware that the pleasure and spontaneity conveyed by those images are not exactly false, but neither do they tell the whole story. The tangible energy of the dance floor often carried a sharp edge of tension. Participants ate, drank, sang, flirted, joked, and danced together. but they also watched each other like hawks. I returned home from nights out completely drained, not just physically, but also emotionally. As a 21-year-old woman, I realized that dancing was about sex and sexuality, among other things, but in a coded way that I did not understand. As time passed, I recognized that these tensions were felt by others too, not always because of sex, although this was never far away, but because prestige and reputation were always at stake. Sometimes quarrels and even fistfights erupted. I began to watch others closely. I learned that in a society where most people dance, dancing involves much more than knowing the steps. It involves social knowledge and social power. I noticed, too, that girls and boys, women and men, acted and reacted in the dance space in quite distinctive ways. I returned home in July 1976 after a few years of working in Chicago. I decided to start a PhD at Indiana University in Bloomington, the only department in the U.S. where I could study dance and music as social and cultural practices in the context of an anthropology degree. I worked with an inspiring group of faculty, Tony Seeger, Ruth Stone, Ivan Karp, Anya Royce, and not least, the incredible Michael Hertzfeld, who is here today. Indiana's unique anthropology-ethnomusicology combination had attracted an extraordinarily talented cohort of doctoral students striving to develop anthropological approaches not just to music making, but to other performative practices, art making, sculpture, theater, ritual. In countless conversations with these teachers and fellow students, I hammered out my doctoral project. I decided to investigate how gender was socially constructed in the dance event, in and through celebratory practices, eating, drinking, singing, gifting, talking, as well as dancing. How celebrants performed in gendered ways, experienced themselves as gendered subjects, and were judged by others. I wanted to explore how gender inequalities and other social hierarchies were constituted and even celebrated in the events associated with pleasure, sociability, and sensual intensity. While my experience in Greece provided core themes, which I framed anthropologically, the project was also marked by my encounter with feminism. I had come of age in the mid-1970s, just as second-wave feminism gained momentum. By 1983, although feminists were still a rare breed in the academy, they were publishing furiously. Feminist writings gave me ways to think about the complexities behind the intransigence of gender inequalities. How and why did women collude in their own domination? If we wanted to understand how gender orders were secured, was it enough to look at threats and sanctions? Didn't we also need to look at identifications and attachments, at the binding powers of love and loyalty, obligation and pleasure? Questions of compliance and accommodation, as well as resistance, seemed to me urgent. Antonio Gramsci's concept of hegemony offered a promising framework for exploring consent and its ambiguities. I was also deeply interested in the dynamics of embodiment, the ways we carry gender ideas in our body, a dialectical process that Pierre Bourdieu described as the appropriating by the world of a body enabled to appropriate the world. How does an anthropologist get access to such experience and the subtle working of power relations? Ethnographic fieldwork involving deep immersion in specific locales has always been the traditional approach. I decided to explore social dancing in the context of a broader community life. For 14 months, I immersed myself in Sochos, a small town of 3,500 people nestled in the mountains about an hour's drive northeast of Thessaloniki. Mostly, I hung out. I drank a lot of coffee with housewives and girls in their houses, with men in Katsoufis' Katsubis there had adopted me. And with the young activists of the Folklore Association in their offices and with shopkeepers in their shops. Various kinds of dance events punctuated the year. Weddings. This is gathering the dowry on the truck. Carnival festivities. Don't know if you can see, but this is not a real man. This is not your normal evening over for a drink, but a bit of transvesticism there. That's better. Shall I go back? Oh, no, I can't. Okay, all right, keep going, yeah, okay. There'll be a few more. It's all right, I can do it with this much light. Yes, I can manage. That's better. All of that is carnival. Then formal dances, sponsored by local clubs. The leaving celebration for a group of 15 local boys drafted into the army. Very typical. They drink ouzo continuously, but he manages to have the wherewithal here to be very dignified. I don't know if you can see the woman crying there. In all of these events, I think you can notice that there are very conventionalized poses, which are very gendered, that men hold their arms up in various kinds of ways and, of course, lie on the ground. And the women are much more contained. But at places like the dinner dances, everyone will show the gestures of sociability and solidarity. I became especially interested in the problems that plagued dances and the fact that dance posed different problems for men and for women. Some men found the obligations of masculinity a burden. They hated to dance at the head of the line, dreaded the public scrutiny and the possibility of failing. Women and girls faced other problems. They eagerly anticipated dances as an occasion to go out and escape from physically and often emotionally confining lives, to let go, relax. But they could never completely forget themselves because they were always defined by their sexuality. They walked a tightrope, having to show themselves attractive, skilled, sexually alluring, yet always in control, never loose. Gender difference was at the center of my work on dance. But Sohoians also lived another form of difference as Bulgarian speakers in the shadow of another hegemony, the Greek nationalism of the Greek state and society. Such ethnic differences in the Balkans are widely portrayed as the legacy of age-old identities, but this is wrong. In order to grasp the experience of difference in the domain of ethnicity, the hegemony of nationalism, and the predicaments that nationalism posed for those imposing it, and for those who were its object, I need to speak briefly about what preceded it. In macrohistorical perspective, the region that came to be known as Macedonia, a frontier and crossroads of empires, has seen numerous migrations. Under Ottoman rule, Macedonia was home to peasants, transhuman shepherds, merchants, musicians, and Ottoman civil servants, speaking various dialects of what we now know as Turkish, Ladino-Spanish, Greek, Vlach, Bulgarian, Macedonian, Albanian, Armenian, and Romani. Probably something I forgot. The Ottomans organized their subjects into religious communities, millet, and well into the 20th century, if you asked a person who she was, she was likely to answer, a Christian from Blagoev or a Jewess from Salonika, regardless of the languages she spoke. This was not a mélange of distinct, internally homogeneous ethnic groups. The proverbial Macedonian salad of apples, peaches, and pears. Rather, it was a world of syncretistic religious practices, linguistic borrowings, and multiple identifications, more or less relevant depending on the context. To think about this concretely, recall Amalia, whose song we heard earlier. In 1912, Mazel Tov Matza, known affectionately as Mali, age 15, born in Istanbul, but raised in Yanina, in what is now Greece, near the Greek-Albanian border, stepped off an ocean liner called Kaiser Franz Joseph I onto Ellis Island, headed for the Lower East Side to marry a nice Jewish boy from home that her parents had chosen for her. Mali became a seamstress alongside her husband, who made silk flowers for ladies' hats. Molly's real passion was singing the Jewish, Greek, and Turkish songs she had grown up with. She started getting singing jobs in the Turkish cafe Amanes, but her husband disapproved. Singing was prostitute's work. He divorced her, taking their daughter back home with him to Greece. She continued singing, now under the name of Amalia, namesake of Greece's 19th century Bavarian queen. She fell in love with a Greek and converted in 1926 to Greek Orthodoxy in order to marry him, choosing to be baptized as Eleni. She spent the rest of her life performing Greek and Turkish songs in the speakeasies and resort circuits linking New York City, the Catskills, and Finger Lakes, and the big Midwestern cities with immigrants from the former Ottoman world, Chicago, Gary, Indiana, Detroit, Philadelphia. The ideal of the pure nation, whose members all speak the same language, have one religion, and live together in one territory. What could this have meant to a person like Mazel Tov, Mali, Amalia, Eleni? Like her, many people in Macedonia had multiple attachments and loyalties. Many did not think of themselves as having a nationality. Much as in Bosnia in the 1990s, it was probably too little national sentiment rather than too much that made the early 20th century Macedonian conflict so brutal. Nationalists had to use violence to force reluctant civilians to take sides. And some people did take sides. According to Sohoian stories, many Bulgarian-speaking Orthodox Christian men joined armed bands to fight on the Greek side against the Bulgarians. Like old Ivanko, the grandfather of one of my elderly informants, Lenyo. So what if he spoke Bulgarian? She insisted. He was Greek. When national borders began to solidify after the Great War, each of the nation states that ultimately won a piece of Macedonia strived to transform such persons into its own national subjects. What I observed in Sochos in 1983 to 85, some 60 years later, bore witness to the uneasy and conflictual processes of identity formation that nation building had entailed in all of these states. In Greece, this was particularly intense for the Slavic speakers. Not only was their language not Greek, it was the enemy's language, and put Slavic speakers under suspicion as Bulgarians, Vulgari, as real or potential traitors. Whereas in earlier moments there had been direct conflict between various Sohoians and various state authorities, by the 1980s, Sohoians had adopted a strategy of ambiguity. The vast majority called themselves simply locals, dopi, people from this place, from the word topos, which you might know. Although this term, ironically, is perfectly understood in the north of Greece to refer to speakers of a Slavic language. In Sohos, almost nobody called that language Macedonian, Makedonika or Makedonska, thus avoiding a name tainted with a history of secession. Rather, they adopted vague circumlocutions, the local language, our language, or, my favorite, Bulgarian, but not the real Bulgarian. Such Sohoian explanations seemed to accept Greek denigration of their mother tongue. It was, they said, not a real language, just a gypsy language. Yet in intimate daily exchanges of friends and neighbors, away from the eyes and ears of Greek officials, Sohoian practice suggested a different attitude. They peppered jokes, stories, and nicknames with Turkish, Bulgarian, and Vlach words, delighting in their distinctive sounds and secret nuances. Circumlocution, double speaking, forms of what Michael Hertzfeld has called dysemia, pointed to the complex bargain between Sohoians and the Greek state since 1912. The poignancy of the Sohoian case intrigued me, a community that vehemently denied being a minority, that had consistently chosen to support the Greek side at many historical points, found itself nonetheless under suspicion, forced to drink castor oil if they spoke their language in public in the 1930s, taunted as Bulgarians at football matches up to the present. Yet if Sohoians have suffered for their difference, they have also learned to exploit its cultural capital. In the 1960s, Greek folklorists discovered their merio, now known as the Carnavali, a masked goatskin clad and bell-bearing ritual figure that they associate with Saint Theodore. Sohoians did not object when the folklorists judged it a living relic of ancient Dionysian rites. In an irony both delicious and bitter, Sohoian Carnavalia, these figures, were invited to participate in the historical parade of the Olympic Games opening ceremonies in 2004 as living representatives of Hellenic continuity from ancient times to the present. What I was seeing during my fieldwork in the mid-1980s was the manifestation in one Macedonian town of the complicated subjectivities that the politics of pure nations had produced in the quintessentially mixed Macedonia. A decade later, soon after I had joined the University of Sussex and moved to Brighton, questions of subjectivity, identification, and political choice reemerged, much more urgently in the context of the breakup of Yugoslavia. When the Federal Republic of Macedonia sought international recognition as an independent state called Macedonia, a Greek response mobilized, decrying the name claim, a theft of history. Billboards, phone cards, shop receipts, and graffiti declared, "Macedonia is one, and it is Greek." All this hoopla obscured a quieter, more localized political movement, the movement for Macedonian human rights, which had begun to gather momentum most actively in Florina, a town in the western side of Greek Macedonia. They called for Macedonians to be recognized as a national minority. Why, by the mid-1990s, had this movement gained significant popular support in the region around Florina? Why, by contrast, had it elicited skepticism among some other Dopi inhabitants of Macedonia? This disjuncture was, for me, the empirical starting point for a broader theorization of culture and rights, a project that I began to develop in collaboration with Marie Dambour and Richard Wilson here at Sussex. In seeing that many in Macedonia rejected the Macedonian human rights narrative, I became alert to the ambiguities of this emancipatory discourse. Just as dance was a site of both power and pleasure, so were rights processes both enabling and constraining. The call for Macedonian human rights was, I argued, a strategy of minoritization. That is to say, in a moment of receptiveness internationally and in Europe for minority claims, and with economic and moral support for Macedonian immigrants in officially multicultural Canada and Australia, activists attempted to build a new collective identity as a minority, defined in terms of separateness and subordination vis-à-vis the Greek majority, oppression by the state, and entitlement to special rights guaranteed by the international community. In building an oppositional discourse that claimed a unified identity, these activists had found it strategically necessary to deny more ambiguous attachments and to suppress more complicated histories of cooperation as well as conflict. The Macedonian human rights movement had more appeal in Florina and less in Sochos, partly because of the two communities' quite specific experiences with earlier nationalisms and with the Greek authorities' attempt to incorporate both these communities in the national body, into the national body. Reflecting on what I observed in Sochos and reading and discussing work which colleagues were beginning to carry out, I knew I wanted to understand better the longer-term political processes that had produced these multiple and varied Macedonian subjectivities. In summer 1997, a conversation with a Greek historian friend, probably at a taverna in Salonika, led me to the League of Nations archives. I told him Sochoian stories that I had heard that a few families had chosen the Bulgarian side in the early years, but that this fact was never mentioned in any of the published local histories. He wondered whether I might find in the League's records some trace of Sochoians who had elected to emigrate to Bulgaria in the 1920s under the rubric of the Greco-Bulgarian voluntary and reciprocal emigration, which the League had supervised. Yes, that rang a bell. Somewhere in my historical reading, I had come across this reciprocal emigration agreement, but I couldn't remember many details. My failure to remember pointed to a larger public silence. The flooding into Greece of 1.5 million destitute Orthodox Christian refugees from Turkey in 1922 and 23, in the context of the compulsory Greek-Turkish exchange of populations, sometimes just called the catastrophe, was an endlessly elaborated theme in Greek public life. The Greek-Bulgarian exchange, by contrast, was never mentioned in public contexts and rarely in academic ones. I did eventually find a trace of Sochoians in the archives. A progress report of 1925 of the Greco-Bulgarian Mixed Commission included tables that listed by district, then by individual village, the number of households that had submitted applications to emigrate, acquire a Bulgarian nationality, while shedding their Greek one, and whether these were completed or still pending. From Sochos, 16 households had applied. Now, this is actually a photo of this period, 1924, where there had been a Greek-Bulgarian border incident, and this is a person, a member of the Greco-Bulgarian Commission, who was sent in to investigate. Another one investigating it in a Bulgarian border village, and I like this. I don't know if you can see, arriving in their big car. It was exciting to find a bureaucratic trace of my village in the files of an international organization. Schematic though it was, it illuminated the local, whereas several surrounding villages were upping sticks and migrating en masse. Only 16 of Sochos's some 800 Christian households chose to depart. The statistical table didn't say why some had left and others stayed, but putting it together with other things I knew, I could speculate. This bureaucratic trace also helped me to imagine the global nexus that managing difference involved. After Greek and Bulgarian diplomats signed the immigration protocol in Neuilly-sur-Seine in 1919, the League of Nations was made responsible to supervise its implementation. League bureaucrats appointed the two neutral members of the four-person mixed commission, and it both advised and administratively supported the vast structure of commissions and subcommissions. They also worked with state diplomats to organize procedures so that a head of household could declare himself a member of the minority, apply to immigrate, and have his property valued and receive compensation. In other words, the League supervised states, but also collaborated with states in registering, categorizing, classifying, and thus transforming persons shaped by an imperial Ottoman regime of difference into the homogeneous national subjects required by the nation state. Here was vivid evidence that national subject making, normally conceptualized as a state process, was also an international process. Long before the typical dating of globalization as perhaps something that happens after the Second World War, here at the beginning of the 20th century, international institutions were affecting life at the local level. Yet the archive files bulged with other kinds of papers. These papers testified to an intense and long-standing preoccupation on the part of a Western European elite in subject nationalities of the Habsburg and Ottoman empires. Liberal Europeans had long encouraged these populations to think of themselves as nations, to revolt against their imperial masters, and to aspire to their own national states. But the nationality principle, motive and justification for the Great War, was an impossible dream. The new map of Europe drawn at Versailles may have given 60 to 75 million people their own nation state, but it left 25 million in somebody else's. Some of these 25 million already saw themselves as nationally distinct from those who formed the majority in their state. Others, like many in Macedonia, did not yet think of themselves as having a nationality at all. The Allies were keenly aware that suffering minorities had all too often been the cause or pretext of conflict between states. But rather than making minority protection universal, which would include Britain with its Irish problem, France with its Bretons and Basques, and Italy with its multinational Tyrol, the Allies imposed these treaties on certain states only. Former enemy states like Hungary and Bulgaria, new states like Poland, and several states that, although not new, had gained new territories, including Yugoslavia, Romania, and Greece. The Allies justified these special obligations by arguing that minorities in these countries were particularly at risk. They compelled these states, dubbed by some scholars as minority states, to sign minorities treaties, granting equal civil and political rights for individual members of what were called minorities of race, language, or religion, as well as certain special rights relating to language, education, and local autonomy. The Allies made the League of Nations an institution still in the making, and this represents that making with the German officer at the window and Bolshevism at the door. They made the League of Nations responsible to guarantee the treaties, but left the practicalities of implementation to an international team of ex-national civil servants who were setting up its secretariat. Civil servants and diplomats gradually invented procedures for supervising the so-called minority states. The most important was the minority petition procedure. It allowed anyone, an individual, a state, an organization, a group speaking as or on behalf of a minority, to submit a letter or petition informing the League when a state had violated its minorities' treaties. Even though the procedure carefully defined the petition as mere information rather than a legal claim, its impact was explosive. As Lucy Mayer noted in 1928, with the petition procedure, in certain countries, a section of the population has a right of appeal, though this appeal is not invariably heard, not possessed of the majority of subjects of that state, to an authority outside and above its own government. This is the greatest abdication of sovereignty which has ever been made by an independent state. Balancing national sovereignty and international intervention based on what is now called the responsibility to protect is still a burning issue. But it is in the League of Nations that, for the first time, the well-being of minorities was defined as an international obligation. At this moment, minority emerged and became consolidated as an international legal political category with teeth. However, from my anthropologist's perspective, this happened not once and for all at Versailles. Rather, minority has to be seen as a category of practice, one that was invoked, negotiated, denied, alongside other categories such as nation or majority. Its career was anything but smooth. I thus resolved in my second major empirical ethnographic project to focus on this process, working outwards from the League of Nations archive. Serendipity again facilitated this, as my partner, Charles Gore, was working at the UN, and our family had, since 1995, made Geneva our family base. In the archives, I found that the petition was the key artifact. It was also the primary material manifestation of claims. I have looked at well over 100 petitions relating to the Bulgarian minorities and dozens of petitions for other causes. Although inscribed by human hands, I have come to see the petition as having a kind of agency of its own. The petition made claims and articulated demands. It instigated encounters between strangers. It generated reactions, readings, commentaries. It traveled, not only from petitioners to the League in Geneva, but often to other sites as well. The petition appeared in European newspapers. It was cited in political speeches. It was passed by hand, by post, to international organizations, to immigrant compatriots in the North American diaspora. It had a career. The decision to guarantee the minorities' treaties through international supervision created, I argue, a new political field. Above all, this was a field of claims making. In the 1920s and 30s, minority petitions concerning the Bulgarian minorities brought together, in contestation, in cooperation, a range of actors spread across the globe, across institutions, across lines of wealth, education, class, and gender, across the political spectrum. We can speak of four broad categories of actor. First, we have petitioners, persons who were minorities or who claimed to speak for or about them. Individuals, student groups, women's groups, choral societies, refugee brotherhoods based in Europe, Naples, Leipzig, Paris, Geneva, Sofia, and the American Midwest, Indianapolis, Springfield, Ohio, Steeltown, Pennsylvania, all wrote letters to the League. They made claims about who they were and what they wanted. Some wanted the right to use mother tongue in schools, churches, and newspapers. Others, Bulgarian-speaking Greek nationals who were refugees in Bulgaria, wanted the right to return home to their villages in Greece. Some wanted protection of their rights as a minority. Even more demanded the right to nationhood, an autonomous Macedonia under protection of the League of Nations. The second category was states, diplomats and ministers who represented states. States might support a minority claim or reply with a counterclaim. Yugoslavia, for instance, declared itself happy to honor its commitment to minorities. Only these people submitting petitions were not a minority. They were not even Bulgarians or even Macedonian Bulgarians. They were South Serbs. Far from being oppressed minorities, these claimants were, in their view, revolutionaries and terrorists. The third category are the international civil servants working for the League, who would have helped, well, the diplomats, this should have gone with the other one, in negotiating the Greek and Turkish exchange, the Treaty of Lausanne. I'm going to go to the next one. Yeah. Okay. This is the minority section whose files I'm reading. The minority section were the gatekeepers mediating between petitioners and states. They were responsible for examining petitions to decide whether they were receivable. Among other criteria, they had to judge whether the language of petitions was sufficiently moderate and rational, or conversely, too violent to be taken forward officially. They approached this task with great creativity, negotiating deftly between states and petitioners and pursuing their own increasingly confident sense of legality and justice. Finally, my fourth catch-all category of concerned world citizens comprises those who felt compelled to act as advocates, who spoke for minorities in various ways, helped them, or served as allies. This category includes individual internationalists like the classicist and social reformer Gilbert Murray, who as state delegate for South Africa lobbied to create a universal minorities regime. It also includes organizations that were the precursors of today's NGOs in terms of their advocacy, their internationalist outlook and outreach, and their diligence in developing working relationships with international organizations. The outstanding example is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which was both developing sister organizations in the Balkans, but also had an office in Geneva in order to be able to work closely with the League. The encounters which petitions generated between these different actors reminded me of the dances I watched years before. Lord Curzon, Ishmet Pasha. Provoked by the petition, many different individuals representing organizations, states, international bureaucracies, or just themselves, step up as if to the dance floor, each with a desire, a project, one that can't be realized except in a collective space. Some try to persuade by confident performance, others by seduction, others by finding allies to support them, others by invoking the rules and expelling miscreants, others by upending the tables and making a scene, and still others by dancing to a different tune, using the space for a different purpose altogether. Very often, in this dance around the petition, even more than on dance floors in Greece, things tend to break down, fall apart, or never properly get going. The narrative I have just offered highlighted some of the twists and turns in my critical journey, the emergence of questions that prompted a move from the dance floor in northern Greece to the fragile faded papers in the Geneva archives. These sites seem so different. One looks local, the other international. One is contemporary, the other set in the past. But there are very strong similarities in how I study these, as my metaphor of dancing in the archives implies. Shifting gears slightly now, I would like briefly to draw out some of these similarities. First of all, the starting point in each project has been the experience of what I would now call non-dominant subjectivities. women in the first instance, and minorities in the second. However, I explore women and minorities not in themselves, but as positions grasped through relations. My first study was not of women, in fact, but of gender, of the ways that being becoming a woman and being becoming a man are mutually constitutive processes. Similarly, with minorities, I was troubled by the taboo on talking about the Slavic speakers in northern Greece, one reinforced by Greece's insistence that, except for the Muslims of Thrace, there were no minorities in Greece. The problem was, my starting point for interrogating this taboo was a community whose members vehemently denied being a minority. How could I, on the one hand, challenge the official silence about those who are different, a silence which had silenced them, and, on the other, honor an anthropological commitment to respect informants' own self-designations and self-understandings? The concept of hegemony took me some way in making sense of this. But there was something unsatisfactory. The debate about minorities tends to be grounded in an assertively realist epistemology. Minorities simply exist. If states say they don't exist, they are denying the patently obvious. If minorities say they aren't minorities, they are victims of hegemonic consciousness, false consciousness, brainwashing, or memoricide. Is there nothing more to say? Because I am very empirical, and because if we are conscientious researchers, the ethnographic reality we capture contains something true and is both the source of our questions and holds the answer to them, I kept returning repeatedly to remarks and stories from my fieldwork, like Lenyo's remark earlier, that her grandfather, Ivanko, was Greek because he chose the Greek side. This led me to think about minority not as something which just exists, but as a category that has to acquire a social reality. In some ways, this recapitulates the debate on class, class in itself versus class for itself, and the role of consciousness. Minority is not only a social relation, but comes to exist through a social process, a process I have called minoritization. And this led me to look for a longer history of this term minority in relation to other terms, nation, race, majority, to look at the struggles around that term, and to see how both the category minority and particular minorities can appear and disappear as a result. A second similarity. I chose to explore these phenomena through a focus on situated interaction. Interaction that occurs is situated in some context or site, which has certain conventions, codes, or rules. This site may or may not be an actual physical place. Even if it is, it has to be imagined. In the first project, I looked at dance events, theorized as conceptually and physically set apart from, although embedded within, the everyday world. In the League project, I am concerned with encounters around the petition set within the political field created by the minority petitions procedure. Interactions have varying timescales. Encounters in the dance may last several hours. Those around petitions may last several years. They may also sit differently within space. Dance events are very localized. Petition encounters are typically transnational. Following from this, a third similarity is my focus on practices rather than either roles or procedures in the abstract, what people are actually doing rather than what they say they are supposed to do. Practices are the means through which certain ideas about gender, about minority, and nation are realized, that is, both comprehended and made real. Dance events involved many practices, not just dancing, but talking, singing, gifting musicians, drinking and eating. And there were ways of doing these things associated with each kind of situation, depending on one's age, gender, and so forth. My League work has looked at the routine bureaucratic practices of the minority section, civil servants, and how these intersected with the multiple practices of petitioners, their supporters, and states. in looking at how the minority section actually examined petitions for receivability across over 100 cases, I have found the practice to be much more complex and varied than the rules of procedure indicate. This variation is not only about the idiosyncrasy of separate cases, but registers negotiations and shifting relationships between states, bureaucrats, petitioners, and advocates, and also shifts between what is happening inside the site, the petition examination in the League Secretariat offices, and outside in the wider world of political action. By focusing on the practices that unfold in particular conceptually bounded sites, I am able to consider the relation between the implicit, the taken-for-granted ways of doing things, the rules and meanings that go without saying, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the divergent, often opposing purposes of actors that lead them to not always follow rules, but to improvise upon, bend, and break them. Fourthly, what these sites share, what makes them compelling to me and to the actors involved, is that both are scenes of claims and claims-making in which participants are preoccupied with issues of justice. Just as interwar petitioners appealed to the League for Justice, demanding rights to nation, so dancers also bring claims to the dance, claims to be recognized, to be respected, to be treated with dignity and equality. We see this when girls strain against the demands of modesty and claim the right to enjoy themselves like a human being and to express themselves freely as men do. We see it when men come to blows because one has preempted the place of a second on the dance floor, violating his autonomy and honor. Consider this real event in the layers of power it embodied. In 1973, when Greece was ruled by a military junta, Nikos Koenzis, a newly paroled ex-con, spending an evening at a dingy nightclub, requested from the musicians a zebekiko, a slow, pensive, anguished solo dance. Every Greek knows the codes. Joining the zebekiko without invitation is a grave insult. A low-ranking policeman asserting the power of the state usurped Koemzi's space and danced to his song. Enraged, Koemzi stabbed him to death. A riot broke out as opponents and supporters of the military state thrashed each other. Everyone understood what was being said. Everybody understood what was at stake in that dance. Finally, I have found it productive in both research sites to pay attention to misunderstanding, conflict, breakdown, and failure. As I saw Greeks pulled in opposite directions in the dance, I came to understand the fragility of the sociability expressed there. Enormously valued, that sociability was a skilled social accomplishment, but could easily fall apart. I became fascinated with such moments. What did they reveal about the contradictory imperatives in the dance? What did they reveal about the cross purposes of different dancers? Working in the archives some years later, I found that focusing on failure, breakdown, unintended consequences could be equally illuminating. Most petitions were deemed non-receivable, often because they were expressed in what was considered to be violent language. But petitioners used such language because it was required to mobilize political support. Indeed, I have argued that for some petitioners, petitions succeeded when they failed. The failure of their petitions was paraded as proof of the failure of international justice and the iniquity of the treaties. Such petitioners posed an alternative to petitioning, the revision of those treaties, or superseding them through revolutionary action to establish an independent Macedonian state. So I'm concluding now. In this professorial lecture, I have been telling a story about myself, but it is also a story about the way that anthropology is changing. My work both reflects those changes and is contributing towards them. In particular, anthropology is trying to address the implication of global processes and a transnationally connected world. This is forcing us to rethink the nature of ethnographic fieldwork and also what our field is. As this occurs, a long-standing tradition of anthropology as critically engaged in the real world is focusing on contemporary global issues such as human rights, violence, migration, poverty, development aid, and the politics of difference. Anthropology is also increasingly recognizing the importance of understanding processes historically. Sussex anthropology is one of the most exciting spaces in Britain for developing innovative engagements with these issues. There has emerged, by a complex organic bubbling up rather than a top-down process, a distinctive style of Sussex anthropology. Ours is an anthropology receptive to interdisciplinary thinking, internationally recognized for its empirically grounded inquiry, as well as its commitment to grasp, interpret, and intervene in an increasingly complex, changing, and unequal world. In our various projects, we are seeking to trace the claims to and contestations over power and meaning that animate cultural and social phenomena. We conceptualize these processes as shaped by an interaction of local, national, and global elements. My own contribution on culture and human rights is quite distinctive. My work in the archives illuminates the forerunner of the present human rights system and precursors to the international NGO movement. But with my local knowledge of the way identities work in this region, now and in the past, I am also able to offer a fresh perspective on these issues. After the dance, petitioning looks very different. I am privileged to be in a department whose faculty and students support each other generously, personally, as well as intellectually, and who hear and respond to each other's ideas with a special mixture of rigor, sympathy, and imagination. I value the egalitarian ethos, the freedom we give each other to follow our individual research passions, but also the immense stimulation of ongoing conversations over shared concerns and collaboration in common projects. Sussex interdisciplinarity has also been deeply important to me. I came to Sussex in 1991 as a member of CCS, the School of Cultural and Community Studies. In its final years, I inhabited a small office along a corridor at the back of Essex House. On my right was a philosopher, then a feminist art historian. On my left, a feminist literary critic, then a media studies person, again feminist, and so on down the corridor. I loved this architecture of interdisciplinarity, the rubbing shoulders on the way to the common room, the chance conversations which led to many important friendships. We have a new architecture now, but interdisciplinarity continues in other forms. For me, through the study for the Center for the Study of Justice and Violence, where I collaborate in research on rights and justice, mentor postdocs, and co-supervise doctoral students with colleagues from law, politics, and international relations. Although I don't underestimate the difficulties of a genuine interdisciplinarity at the intellectual level, as well as at the level of practical organization within an institution, I have benefited profoundly from contact with other perspectives, other ways of seeing and framing questions, and have felt liberated by the implicit permission, even invitation, to go beyond established boundaries. As the university continues to grapple with new challenges, we must fight to preserve spaces for creativity and serendipity in the research process, and to support the interdisciplinarity, which is such a marvelous source of creativity. It is so important to continue to enable the type of adventure which I have enjoyed and tried to convey to you this evening. Let me end by saying thanks to the many people who have accompanied me on this journey in one way or another. First and foremost, Charlie and my sons, Zach and Andrew, my parents, my sister Marcy and brother Richard, Michael Hertzfeld, Marie Dambour, Bob Morton, Yael Navarro-Yashin, Annie Whitehead, James Fairhead, Keith Brown, all my colleagues in anthropology, the wonderful women in my senior women's learning action set, my DPhil students, Sue Hepburn from the events office, and so many others. Thank you.